Good afternoon. I'm Kathy Lewis. Have you ever served as a caregiver for a family member? If your answer is yes, that wouldn't be surprising. You know firsthand how rewarding and taxing the job can be. The world of caregiving is growing, requiring better education and support for those joining the ranks. That's why Southeastern Senior Services of Southeastern Virginia is hosting an expo on caregiving next month. We'll talk about it today. We'll also get the perspective of Virginia Beach's former city manager on light rail, that big vote coming up November 8th. Let's talk about it after this news from NPR. Good afternoon. I'm Kathy Lewis. It's 6 minutes past noon. We are awfully glad to have you with us today. Do want to give you a couple of heads ups, I guess is how we might say that. Coming up on November 10th on WHRO TV 15 is going to be a great program at 10 o'clock on military medicine. And we want to let you know about that because we have produced a show that will probably be on before that, or at least it will be on the web, and we'll give you the date and time and all that for it. But this is I want you to make sure you put that on the calendar because this is going to be a very, very interesting show for those of you who have benefited from military medicine, because it is featuring Bob Woodruff, who is the ABC News anchor, who was very critically injured, you will recall, right after taking the anchor spot from in the wake of Peter Jennings' death at ABC. He was working in Iraq, landmine blew up, knocked his vehicle, blew his vehicle up. He was very seriously injured, took almost a year to recover. And in the course of that year, he learned a lot about military medicine and the folks who were going through that process, which, as you know, is lengthy and costly. And the fact of the matter is, if you can get somebody in the military who's been badly injured to a hospital in the field, you'll have about a 96% rate of saving their lives. But of course, then there's a whole set of other issues that come from that. And so this is going to be a very interesting program, 10 o'clock on Thursday, November 10th, that will walk through the incredible, incredible lessons that military medicine has taught and that are being very much integrated into civilian medicine as well, particularly from a trauma perspective. So I hope you'll stay tuned for that. It's a very interesting conversation. A little later in the program, we will talk with Jim Spohr. He is the former city manager for Virginia Beach, having been there for 24 years, led that city through a number of significant developments, including a water crisis, including the development of Town Center, and before he left, putting light rail on the agenda, the big vote coming up November 8th. It's a non-binding referendum, and at the moment, the polls in that vote pretty close. So you'll hear Jim Spohr's perspective on light rail, having been at the helm of that city for 24 years and now having a regional post as president and CEO of Reinvent Hampton Roads. And then a little later in the broadcast, Mal Vincent comes along to talk about Oliver Twist, which is the new production from the stage company. So honestly, I don't know how we could have packed more in an hour for you, but that's how we roll. We're glad to have you with us today. It's 9 minutes past the hour in the first half of our program. We are talking about caregiving, and I got to tell you, I'm sure that you have either been cared for or offered care for someone else. It is something that is becoming so much more a part of our lives as people are living longer, as families are becoming more dispersed across the country and around the world. Women still make up 60% of the family caregiving population, and about 2 in every 5 adult Americans are caring for loved ones, 2 in 5. Most of those who are doing the caring are also working full or part-time. And when you look at the fact that women still make up the majority of that population, they are increasingly leaving their jobs in order to provide the care that needs to be provided. Most of these women in their 50s, so in their prime earning years. And the cost of that over a lifetime is more than $300,000 when you have to leave your job because of caregiving. In fact, 11% of all caregivers end up having to quit their job to care for someone at home around the clock. So it is a pretty extraordinary issue. 1/3 of all boomer women, these are women between 52 and 70, are caring for an elderly parent from anywhere from about 8 to 30 hours a week in addition to their time at work. So this is a crunch that's happening all across the country. We're talking about it today, as they are at Senior Services of Southeastern Virginia. They're doing a big conference on this. It's called The Art of Healthy Aging. It's a forum and expo. That's also going to be Thursday, November 10th from 9 to 2 at the Virginia Beach Convention Center in Virginia Beach. And they're going to be terrific opportunities for you to learn more about caregiving, about healthy aging. Tickets are on sale now, and you can get a ticket at SSSEVA.org. We're at 11 minutes past the hour. Dr. Lisa Isom will be the keynote speaker at the aforementioned conference. She's the executive director at the Rosalind Carter Institute for Caregiving at Georgia Southwestern State University. Dr. Isom, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to be here with you today.
I know that your focus is largely around caregiving, and particularly around the military and dementia. It's an extraordinary challenge. We just talked about some of the statistics that are currently defining that universe. What issues are you noticing? What trends are you noticing that are affecting the world of caregiving?
Well, I think you've already stated that caregiving impacts women more, because in the absence of a spouse, a daughter or a daughter-in-law is most likely to assume that caregiving role. And I think you'll see, too, that the average senior today, when you're looking at our older adults, will spend two or more of their final years disabled enough to need someone to help with routine activities of daily living because of chronic illnesses and because of disabilities. You know, I think one of the trends we're seeing and one of the changes we're seeing in our caregiving support, and they're very needed changes, that the programs, the caregiver cannot leave the home always. And so the use of telephonic caregiver support programs, use of Skype, use of FaceTime, and the delivery of caregiver support programs is changing the face and the way we reach out to caregivers.
So give us an example of that, the telephonic caregiver support. How would that work?
Well, we have one here. It's called the Benjamin Rose Institute Care Consultation Program. Largely what we do at the Institute is do training. We train agencies so they can have these resources in communities across the United States. In particular, you ask about the telephonic one. It's an empowerment program. The training part of it, we in the agency piece, people can call in, and they work with that caregiver for an entire year. And they have a multiple of points of contact with them, and they can email them plans of care. They can ask questions. They can ask whatever problem they're identifying with, because a thorough assessment is done on the front end of the relationship, and they work through those problems and any other problems that occur, and they bring to the forefront. And it's had very good results. We do metrics on all of our programs, Well, we do metrics for program satisfaction, but I'm talking about program impact. Mm-hmm. Did it indeed change the life of the caregiver? Was the burden less? Was the depression less? Were their needs met? Those are the kind of things we measure our pre- and post-program, so we know that the programs work. Because at the end of the day, that's what's the most important, that the caregiver was supported and felt empowered and that their needs were met.
Yeah.
Because when that happens, then usually the environment of the loved one improves. So you're affecting both people, the caregiver and the care recipient.
It strikes me as well that as people are living longer, this caregiving period is going to go on for longer.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We're living longer.
We're at
definitely
15 minutes past the hour. That's Dr. Lisa Isom. She's going to be keynoting the Art of Healthy Aging Forum and Expo. That's Thursday, November 10th, 9 to 2. At the Virginia Beach Convention Center in Virginia Beach. And they're going to have a lot of great seminars there. They're going to have a one on support for military and caregivers, one on aging well, one on health care, one on keeping the keys. I'm guessing that's probably around driving. Kathy Dalton is living this story firsthand. She's a senior vice president at Town Bank. So she is a full-time working woman, and she is also a family caregiver. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. So give us your caregiving profile, if you will. You have two parents.
I have two parents. In the last 6 years is when it all really changed for us.
Yeah.
They went to two assisted living facilities. Dad's a little hard-headed and wouldn't push the button and was falling too much. So he has now got to the point where he needed more skilled care. So he is at a nursing facility now. Mm-hmm. My mom has moderate dementia. Dad's Parkinson's is advancing daily.
And are they at the same facility?
Yes,
different
they are.
Facilities? Okay.
They are. And we've been able to keep them together like mm-hmm. that. That's been very important to us. They'll be married 64 years in March.
Wow, it's amazing.
And having each other is very important.
Did you have them at home before they went into assisted scenario?
Actually,
or their home?
They were living in Elizabeth City, North Carolina at the time. And it got to the point where, you know, Dad was falling so much, and my mom was 80 at the time. Mm-hmm. She couldn't keep picking him up.
Sure.
And I think he lived in denial a little bit until the doctor finally said, it's time.
Yeah.
And once that
so you were having to go down there every time you got the call that somebody fell.
Yes. And so the neurologist said, you know, I think it's time. Well, as soon as Dad heard that, it was time right now. And everything
had to
take
place.
So, what
was that like for you to, because you're a big old executive at Town Bank, you've got a very weighty job. What was that experience like for you balancing all of that?
Well, I'm fortunate that I have such a wonderful employer. I mean, I've worked with the management now for 30 years. Family always came first. Even when my children were growing up, if you had a ball game to be at, you'd be there.
And that is very much the town story.
That is our culture. That is our culture. But it did make it very difficult. Because I would go down and spend days at a time in Elizabeth City. The nice thing is I can work remotely. Mm-hmm. So I have a wonderful team to support me. And the management, as long as I have that support.
You know, whenever I hear a story like yours, and I very much appreciate that, you are a senior manager working for an incredibly supportive company. I think about the people who are not senior managers. I think
exactly.
about the people who are hourly employees
exactly.
who may not be working for you know, very, which, mm-hmm. you know, gosh, you hope they are, but who may not be working mm-hmm. for such
I have one on
employers.
My team.
Really?
Right now.
Yeah.
Whose father has severe dementia and was at the hospital till midnight last night.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, so when she calls and says, I'm going to be a little late, I'll say, you take your time.
Right.
Because
wow.
I know.
It's amazing. It's a tough road to hoe. Mm-hmm. 17 minutes past the hour. We want to hear your stories of caregiving today at 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Are you one of those people who has had to make changes and accommodations in your work schedule? Maybe you have reduced your hours. Maybe you've left the workforce to care for a relative. 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Dr. Isom, you know, I wonder from a public policy perspective, this is something that candidates are beginning to talk about, that lawmakers are beginning to address. What do you see from a policy perspective that is responding to the trends that we've been describing?
Well, you know, there has been a call out for the CARE Act, which is a legislation. It was passed in Virginia, in your state, on June the 8th. Which supports family caregivers when their loved ones go into the hospital. So they are guaranteed that they'll be identified on the assessment intake reform, and also they'll get training when they leave in case their loved one needs some kind of wound dressing or any other kind of training material before they go. I think to date, 33 states have passed the CARE Act. We're still waiting on the other 17. But if you go federally and you're looking at policies from a national base, there is one that has passed the Senate but has not passed the House yet. It's called the RAISE Act. It's for Recognize, Assist, Include, Support, and Engage. It would call for the United States Department of Health and Human Services to develop a national strategy to recognize and support family caregivers and address many of the issues that you've already talked about mm-hmm. today.
There are about 1.7 million caregivers in Virginia right at this moment. They are providing about $11 billion worth of care if those folks were provided for in facilities. These are people who are at home, who are caring for loved ones, who are trying to remain in their home for the rest of their lives or for as much of their lives as is possible. It is an extraordinary challenge moving forward. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom is on the line now from Virginia Beach. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi, Kathy. How are you today?
All right.
Hey, Kathy, just another aspect of, as you said, people in their 50s is military members in their 50s. I was a 50-plus-year-old mm-hmm. senior leader in our Navy, and suddenly my mother needed, you know, I needed to care for my mother. And that was an incredible stress. And then we saw across the Navy as the years, that was about 10 years ago, as the time went on, and as you say, people lived longer, that we had more senior leaders, senior chiefs, master chiefs, commanding officers, all struggling. And so the Navy put together a program to help them deal with that.
Ah.
I wanted to share one other thing with you. I was out at Balboa Hospital, where they had hundreds of military injured that had been going on for, obviously, for the last 13, 14 years. And I asked one of the caregivers out there how he was. Mm. He'd been telling me all about his patients and all about how the wounded were cared for when they came in. And I asked how he was, and all of a sudden he started tearing up. And I mean, wow. I wasn't prepared for that at all.
Yeah.
But I wonder if your guest could address the stressful program stress relieving program to help those kind of caregivers.
Yeah, it's such a great question, Tom. And thank you, and thanks for calling in today with your experience. We know that caregiving can cause depression, anxiety, guilt, sadness, dread, worry, all the rest of it. Dr. Lisa Isom is with us today from the Rosalind Carter Institute for Caregiving at Georgia Southwestern State University. She's going to be keynoting this conference. Dr. Isom, I wonder, what are we able to do for people who are in the kinds of emotional stress that Tom describes?
It's a very good question that Tom brings to the discussion table. I think that we should realize that there's a sea of goodwill to help those that have served our country and those that care for them. But we need to be careful that the programs that we engage in are evidence-based. And that means that they came from a randomized control trial, and they know that scientifically they work. But they've also had been translated out in the community. So we know I mentioned earlier about the importance of program impact. There is such a program, Tom. It's called Operation Family Caregiver. You can access it on OperationFamilyCaregiver.org. It's a free service, and it provides you with a trained coach that will work with the caregiver. It's located, we have 14 sites. It is one of the Rosalind Carter Institute programs. Mm-hmm. We have 14 sites across the nation, but it's delivered via Skype and FaceTime as well as face-to-face in person. You don't have to be in that geographic location. You can sign up for free on that website. And that coach works with the family for over 4 to 6 months to look at issues that are important to that family. It is tailored to that family.
Yeah. We're at 23 minutes past the hour. We have a Facebook post from Melody who says that FMLA should include in-laws, and we are certainly aware of circumstances in which an in-law, whether male or female, is the one who is providing much of the day-to-day, hands-on caregiving process. So that's a very interesting perspective. Of course, FMLA only covers Family Medical Leave Act, only covers employers of a certain size and larger. So it doesn't cover small and medium-sized employers. So this role of in-laws, it seems to me, Kathy Dalton, very important to consider, because it may not, you know, a couple may determine this one needs to go out and keep the job and do the job and work. This one has a better benefit mm-hmm. scenario that might accommodate that.
I can't tell you the number of times I said to myself, gosh, you know, what if I quit my job and took care of myself? We are very fortunate that Dad planned for this very well, for he and Mom. They have long-term care. And those are the type of financial planning things people need to start thinking about now. But it's difficult. You get them in these facilities. They do help them with their day-to-day activities. But you have to continue to be an advocate. So while you might not be there physically, you have to be an advocate for them. Watch everything.
Right.
Listen to what they're saying. And address it when you need to.
This is so important, too. And I think it's a particular stress for people who are not in the local area, you know, that you can't be that person who goes into the facility every day. And, you know, we have some great facilities in the region, and they do as fine a job as they could do. But there are a lot of people, and it is probably true. What is it they say, you know, a watched pot never boils. And,
right.
and you know, you wonder about the role of someone coming in and checking every day or very frequently just to
the
make sure.
The more they see you, the better.
Fair enough. 25 minutes past the hour. It's 440-2665, 1-800-940-2665. 2240 are the numbers where you can join us today. We're talking about caregiving. Again, it still predominantly falls to women. There are new statistics out that point to the economic impact of caregiving, particularly for this population that we're talking about. One-third of baby boomer women, 52 to 70, currently caring for an elderly parent, as few as 8 and as many as 30 hours a week, in addition to their time at work. So we want to hear about your story. We'd love to hear as well, what would be helpful to you as you navigate that path? We've heard from Melody, who says, let's extend FMLA to in-laws. That's a really interesting point, particularly because families work out caregiving in different ways, depending on what's best for them and what's best for their loved ones. But we're talking about caregiving today. I want to hear from you. 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Dr. Isom, it strikes me that when a caregiving scenario is complete, as at some point it will be for Kathy Dalton, that becomes so much a part of your life. What happens to caregivers after the person for whom they've been caring dies? I mean, what is that process like?
You know, it's different for each person, and that's what we found. However, they still need support because that part of their life has now passed and they have to move forward. We have a program. I know that Kathy's dealing with dementia with her parents. The REACH program, and you know that we've done a tremendous amount of work in the area of dementia and Alzheimer's disease. But that support program works with the families even after the loved one passes on.
Okay.
For a few more mm-hmm. visits to help them accommodate, you know, and talk through that grieving process, even
yeah.
though they've had time to know that the end will
sure.
be coming. They still are going to need some support past that.
It's a great point. 27 minutes past the hour. I want to get Regina in the line in the program mm-hmm. before we have to end this conversation. Regina's on the line from Gloucester. Hi, Regina. What's on your mind today?
This is a wonderful, timely discussion. I thank you so much, Kathy, for hosting it. I am the primary caregiver for my mother. Three mm-hmm. other siblings spread around the country.
Yeah.
It seems this is a very common situation.
Sure.
And it also seems that there is one, maybe another sister, or who knows, who might think that you're not handling a crisis moment very well, but they're not there.
Yeah.
And that seems common with the other caregiver women I talk with in
yeah.
their 60s for their elderly moms. And then one of my siblings moved closer to Raleigh. I just was hooting and screaming, thank you, God, for help getting me a sibling close so that, and I told him when he got here, and his wife, they're wonderful.
Yeah.
You're 3 hours away, you're coming once a month.
And good for you. Good for you for being direct about that and saying, this is what I need, right?
Absolutely.
That's the thing to do. Kathy would agree with that, yes?
Absolutely. Family dynamics play a huge role.
Yeah.
You've got to have that family support. And we have a few family dynamics going on in our area, and we all live locally.
You do?
Yeah, it all,
everybody
you know,
seems to.
Once the point of contact was decided, which
yes.
was me, things started to change a little bit in that perhaps they thought things should be handled in a different way and stuff like that. But it really all comes down to what your loved one wants.
Yeah.
They make the as long as they can make the decision, let them make the decision.
Yeah, it's such a good point. Mm-hmm. And this is a very, Regina, thank you for the call from Gloucester today. This is a very, very common problem, second guessing the people who are on the scene, who have the responsibility and who have the pressure of that 24 hours a day, seven mm-hmm. days a week. So having observed this up close, I would say if you are in that position, you're the out-of-town child, don't be second-guessing them unless you really know that there's something going on that's bad, because that's not supportive at all. If you can't be there 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, then try hard to be supportive of what's going on. And visit often and call often mm-hmm. and send your sibling there a mm-hmm. gift certificate to go out to dinner once in a while.
And for Regina, there are plenty of services available where she can go take
yes.
some time.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because a lot of those services are available through senior services if you're in Southeastern Virginia. And there is, by the way, an agency on aging everywhere across the country. Every community has an agency on aging. They have programs you may not be aware of that can help support you as you go about this. The other thing they do, which is so terrific, is they have great access to resources in the community about which you may not be aware. This is a type of information that you only need for a limited part of your life. And so there's no need to walk around with that expertise all the time. Let the good folks at the agencies on aging help you out with that, because they have great resources for caregiving, for taking care of things, for all the sort of the continuum of care that needs to happen.
Absolutely. And at first, everything is overwhelming.
Yeah.
Extremely overwhelming. But as time goes on and a routine becomes more of a routine, you realize you're much stronger than you thought you ever could be.
Ever could be.
And in fact, Dr. Isom mentioned a little while ago, at the end of the day, I've got to the point now where I've started a blog.
Really?
For I've had so many people ask me about things we've experienced with our family that I have started a blog, and it's titled At the End of the Day.
Oh, what a good title.
Meaning, would I have done anything differently?
Yeah.
Or would I have regretted any decision I made?
And you know, the thing of it is, you're in the moment. You do the best you can. And I think you have to be gentle with yourself on that, too.
Absolutely.
Right? You make the best decisions you can in the moment. Mm-hmm. If you had every bit of information, you might do something different. But the fact is, you often don't. And if you lead with what's best for the person you're caring for, that's oftentimes, I think, about the best you can do. I think it's about the best you can do. Dr. Lisa Isom, thank you for being with us today. Kathy Dalton, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Senior Vice President at Town Bank. And again, what a great organization. And I've heard that from soup to nuts, that from the time, and that's a leadership issue. That's something that Bob Astin clearly sets out as a priority. He always talks about that, but it clearly infiltrates the entire organization. And now that things are expanding beyond Hampton Roads for town, one hopes that will continue in those new locations as well.
As we've grown over the last 18 years as Town Bank, I mean, you've seen no change in that.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I wish you very well. I wish your parents well. I wish them long and happy lives, and I wish you wonderful, comfortable days and the opportunity to get all the support that you need.
Thank you.
I love your blog. I love the title of your blog. Mm-hmm. The conference is coming up again Thursday, November 10th. It's going to be at the Virginia Beach Convention Center. It's going to be a great opportunity for you to take a look at this issue of healthy aging. So I do hope you'll take advantage of that. It's SSSEVA.org. That is the website where you can learn more about it. And it's a really important opportunity to take a look at keeping your own self healthy, because you can't care for anybody else unless you're caring for yourself as well. It's not a selfish act. It's actually a preservation act, and a good thing. So we'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back. As Virginia Beach residents get ready to contemplate a non-binding vote on the future of light rail in the city, we wanted to talk with Jim Spohr, who spent 24 years as the city manager of Virginia Beach. It was actually on his watch that this whole process got started. He now has a position regional in nature as the president and CEO of Reinvent Hampton Roads. Jim Spohr, nice to have you with us today. Thanks for being here.
Kathy, thank you for the opportunity.
You bet. So this has been a very interesting conversation about light rail, and we note that the polls at this moment look like this vote is going to be very close. I'm interested in your perspective as somebody who spent 24 years leading this city, noted as one of the best managed cities in the nation. Congratulations on that. Why did you decide to put light rail on the agenda? What was your thinking in that regard for this, on behalf of the city first?
Well, I think this is the key to the whole issue, is what is the vision for our community and how did we get to where we are? What's the context of this vote that's going to be coming up in November? And I think in order to make a good choice, you really need to have the background and the context of where we are as a city. For a lot of people who have lived in Virginia Beach all their life, they have a hard time accepting the fact that we are essentially a built-out community in Virginia Beach. Back in the 70s, we were the fastest growing city in the United States. That that growth is tapered off, we're essentially built out. So any additional development is going to be coming from a redevelopment perspective, which is a very difficult, very time-consuming, very expensive proposition. So the challenge that we saw a number of years ago was, what do we do when there's no greenfield left to develop? And we came up with a strategy of trying to create areas of opportunity for redevelopment and development, additional density. And those are called strategic growth areas. There are 8 of those in the city. The council, I think, has done a fantastic job in terms of setting out that vision. This is something that has been in the works for the last 3 comprehensive plans in the beach, which is over a 15-year period. The 8 strategic growth areas were adopted by vote of council over a period of about 6.5 years. And then more recently, about 4 years ago, we had the Vision 2040 plan, which kind of rolled that all together into a comprehensive view of what did we want the city of Virginia Beach to look like in the year 2040. And it simply said, we're out of land to develop. We don't want to go south of the Green Line. We don't want to get down to the North Carolina and do a lot of...
Green Line, for those who are new, who may be new to the community, is sort of a line that was established below which development would not occur.
That's correct. It's kind of the urban services boundary beyond which utilities are not going to be extended and services aren't going to be at a very high level. So we don't want to get down there in the wetlands and the environmentally sensitive areas. So the only option left for us to have a viable economic future is to develop this game plan that says, let's take advantage of this notion of densifying along public transportation. And as luck would have it, in Virginia Beach, we happen to have Interstate 264, we have Virginia Beach Boulevard at 8 lanes, and we have an abandoned rail line that runs straight through the center of the city. And all 3 of those parallel each other, and what a fantastic opportunity that presents to the community to take these small areas, like the town center, sort of the prototype, they'll all be different, but that's an example, and create that additional development that will lead to choices for living, choices for transportation, and choices for our economic future. And we feel that without that, we are facing a difficult economic time in Virginia Beach if we cannot continue to prosper and develop.
You know, it's interesting because the last time we talked about this issue on this broadcast, we heard from at least one caller, maybe more, who said, well, you know, I hear what you're saying about growth. Mm-hmm. Maybe we don't want to grow. Mm-hmm. What would be the implications of not growing? I mean, yeah. Is that a decision you can make?
Some cities around the country have chosen that, and I think history has shown that that's been a bad decision. Austin, Texas, for example, back in the 70s and 80s, decided they did not want to grow. And what happened was the growth went around them in the undeveloped areas in the counties, and Austin had to back off of that and create an environment that could attract additional development within their community. So, and I could give you others. I mean, my background happens to be in city planning, and that's an absolute great question. I think if you are willing to accept the fact that you will not be having jobs for your younger people to take and stay in your community, if you're willing to accept endless increases in property taxes to support the services that you've come to expect, and we're blessed to have a very high level of service in Virginia Beach. If you're willing to pay for that and see your taxes increase over time, then I think you can take that status quo position. Personally, I think the cities that have tried that have seen stagnation rather than prosperity, and I think it would be a very unfortunate choice if that's the message that comes out of this referendum.
This has been a very interesting thing to watch, because certainly there is a conversation around the cost of it, up now $243 million less, much less than the original estimates, mm-hmm. And of course the eventual destination, all the rest of it. But I was at an event a couple of weeks ago, and I was talking to someone who is in her 80s, who said, if this referendum fails, it will be because of angry old people who don't want the city to move forward. I thought this was an interesting statement coming from someone who is herself in her 80s. Mm-hmm. So it's been very interesting to watch the sort of sub-conversations that this question has surfaced around race relations, around age demographics and the like.
It's absolutely true. And I think we need to respect all of those viewpoints and openly talk about them and hopefully come to a consensus on what the best direction is for the community. I think if you look at demographics, and you mentioned that, the fastest growing demographic in Virginia Beach is the 80 plus age group. The other, the boomers, are rapidly increasing in terms of percentage. The millennials, on the other hand, are actually projected to decrease between now and 2030. So we need to do some things that creates the kind of a community where our younger people will want to stay, number one, and hopefully that we can attract younger workers, young professional workers into our area. So this issue on transportation is really about choice. It's the choice, the kind of community we want, the kind of housing we want, the range of choices, and most importantly, how do we propose to connect to the rest of the region, and how do we propose to get around within the city of Virginia Beach? There's a lot of people, elderly, students, healthcare workers, workers in the tourism industry, that really depend on public transportation and will to a greater extent in the future. So I think we need to seriously think about that. Even though we may ourselves not want to use public transportation, there are a lot of people out there that depend on it.
It was interesting because a couple of weeks ago, again, when we were talking about this, somebody said, well, you know, I never see anybody on the light rail. And another caller made the point, well, that kind of depends on the time you're looking. Because if you look early in the morning in the commuter hours, they are really quite full and the commuter lots are quite full. What do the projections tell you about the extension to Town Center and what that may mean in terms of ridership? Will the extension sort of lift the whole thing, or does it give the option for people from Town Center to get on the train and come in and stop anywhere along the way?
Well, it's important to remember that the Tide is a starter system. It really doesn't end anywhere. It stops out at Newtown Road at the city limit.
And was never intended to be anything more than a starter line, just for those who are new to the community. It was not intended to be, that's the be-all, end-all.
Yeah, the vision is a network that would connect the entire region, but it's kind of like building a portion of a street and then wondering why there's not a lot of traffic on it. The estimates in the EIS indicate that the extension to Town Center would increase the ridership on the Tide by about 25%. I think it'll be more than that as the system matures. And you need to be aware that one of the things that the Federal Transit Administration does is they focus on those work trips that you mentioned. What's the peak work trip? All of the shopping trips, the entertainment trips, the let's go out to eat trips, those are not really included in some of those numbers. So when you think about what it could become if it connected downtown Norfolk to Town Center in Virginia Beach, the two central areas of the two largest cities in the state of Virginia, I think it will then finally represent an operable segment that makes some sense, and we'll see some significant increases in ridership.
We're talking with Jim Spohr, who spent 24 years leading the city of Virginia Beach, led it to AAA bond ratings, led quite a lot of redevelopment at that point, including Town Center, including the development of the Resort Center, the expansion of the Virginia Aquarium, Museum of Contemporary Art. He also was in the city manager's chair when the decision was made to extend light rail to Town Center. That question about whether to go through with those plans is on the ballot in November. It is a non-binding referendum, but the city council will certainly be taking a close look at what that vote is. At the moment, the polls seem to indicate that it is a very, very, very close vote. Jim Spohr, I wonder, you are now in a regional position, and we'll talk about that in a moment, but there is this issue of the money that the state has put on the table to assist with this project and what happens to it if there's an indication that the city is not fully on board with this. I wonder if you could talk through those implications.
Well, it's a fantastic opportunity that's been presented to us. And, you know, the referendum that we had in 2012 really asked people to weigh in on whether or not we should investigate and take all reasonable steps to explore extending the light rail. And that's exactly what the council and the city have done. During the course of that exploration and negotiation, the Commonwealth Transportation Board, the governor of Virginia, came forward with an unprecedented offer of $155 million of state funds to help us get this extension accomplished. That really is a unique opportunity that I hope we do not pass up, because it will never come again. And if you look at the federal scene, there's a lot of competition. There are 38 projects in the federal queue for federal funding to help extend light rail around the country. If we had to get in the back of that line, it would be 10, 15, 20 years before we would get funding. So this offer of this additional funds from the state really sets up, I think, a very, in my opinion, easy economic decision. The engineering estimates, as you pointed out, have come down as the design progresses and more is known about the construction techniques and things that will need to be done to build this system. And with that number down at $243 million, which still includes about $29 million in contingency funds, that means that the state is going to be paying for almost 65% of the extension. So we as local taxpayers only have to pick up the 35%. So that gets the city's commitment down in the range of somewhere between $60 and $89 million. We routinely spend more than that on improving a single intersection in the city.
Wow.
So to be able to get that backbone transportation system extended, to be able to connect those two centers of the two largest cities in the Commonwealth, I think is an enormous opportunity. A lot of people are not aware of that, which is why I appreciate the opportunity to be on your program, that those new estimates just came in earlier this month. A lot of people are not aware of that. Another thing that they're not aware of is that if we do not proceed with the project, we have to pay the state back $20 million that was used in state funds to acquire the rail right-of-way. So a no vote doesn't mean you have no expense. A no vote means you don't get anything, and further, you have to pay the state back the $20 million that they've advanced in the right-of-way acquisition.
Privately, I've heard people say that as concerning as anything else is the message that will be sent to the gubernatorial administration, the legislature, if this vote does not pass, because it will be an indication that if Virginia Beach doesn't want it, then let's just walk away from that.
Well, frankly, there's a number of people around other portions of the Commonwealth of Virginia that hopes that we do turn it down because they want to get that money. And that's another thing that people don't seem to understand. They say, why don't you spend that $155 million on something else? The point of fact is it's earmarked for this project and this project only. If we do not proceed, that money goes back to the Commonwealth of Virginia and will be spent on road projects or transit projects in other parts of the state. So money that we've already paid in terms of state taxes and gas taxes and other sources would be going to projects somewhere else in the state, and we would get none of that benefit.
You know, I wonder as well, it's interesting because we've been talking a lot about presidential leadership in this cycle. And just this week, I was talking with some folks at a forum who were saying, one of the issues that is increasingly defining leadership is the practice of constantly checking in to see where voters are on an issue and adjusting opinions appropriately. Mm-hmm. And this person said, look, there's nothing wrong with checking in with voters. That's a great idea. This is what we're all about. We should be doing that. But there was a vote in 2012 to proceed with this. And so I guess I wonder, from the perspective of a city manager who works with city council, elected city council members, now that the shackles are off you, I wonder what thoughts you have about that question, about that delicate balance between checking with the voters and those moments where you have to say, I get your concerns, but I'm looking down the road here. This is what I see, and this is where I think we should go.
I'm a strong believer in representative democracy, and I think that's what the founders had envisioned when they wrote the Constitution, when James Madison got together with a few other folks and wrote the Constitution of the United States. They anticipated, I think, representative democracy. Doesn't mean you don't check in with the voters, but I think the voters elect our representatives to spend the time, to spend the energy, to make sure that all the T's are crossed, the I's are dotted on various issues, and then make the best decision that they can based on the information that they have. This issue has been one that has taken on a life of its own, but I think if you look back, as we were discussing earlier, this has been a concept that's been talked about for over 15 years in Virginia Beach. We have had literally hundreds of public hearings, public meetings on these strategic growth areas, on the Vision 2040 plan, on the comprehensive plans, on the decision to purchase the right-of-way. All along, the council has touched base with the community in terms of public comments, public hearings, outreach sessions, design charrettes, all kinds of techniques to try and be in touch with what that public opinion is and trying to forge a path that says this is the smartest thing we can do considering where we are, considering our and where we want to go in the future. I think part of the question to some of the folks that are not in favor of light rail is, well, what is your plan? If this doesn't go forward, what's your game plan for prosperity in Virginia Beach? What's your game plan for providing jobs for your children and grandchildren? And so far, I haven't heard an answer to that. I was out at a Civic League last night in Bay Colony, and one of the no proponents said, well, we just need another war. This economy in this region is based on the defense establishment, so we'll have another war, and then the economy will turn around. I don't think that's a strategy we want to sign up for. There are better ways to grow our region and to provide the kinds of jobs that our kids need.
Speaking of growing the region, of course, that is your initiative now, having retired from the city management of Virginia Beach, serving as president and CEO of Reinvent Hampton Roads. So as you look at the light rail question from a regional issue, what do you see?
Well, I think the vision for public transportation is really important to this region. And I think the vision plan that's been put together by HRT and other communities,
Hampton Roads Transit, mm-hmm.
includes the eventual extension of light rail to the oceanfront, the eventual extension to Old Dominion, up to the Navy base, hopefully a line out to Chesapeake. Those lines are now being studied by HRT, the city of Chesapeake, the city of Norfolk. And so it's an essential component, but it's only a part of a transportation system. We're taking a look at every possible option. There's certainly going to be roadway improvements. There's going to be bus system improvements that feed off the light rail. There's going to be BRT over on the peninsula.
Bus rapid transit.
Sorry. bus rapid transit on the peninsula. Extensive system of bike paths and trails. So it's really a comprehensive network of choices that we're trying to put together that I think connects this region in a way that has never been connected before, and I think is going to be so fundamentally important to creating the kind of place that we want to live in 30 or 40 years.
Jim Spohr, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it. Congratulations on a tremendously successful career in Virginia Beach. In fact, the reason we are recording this conversation today is because at the moment it airs, Jim Spohr will be receiving a very prestigious public service award from Old Dominion University, and so he'll be giving live remarks there. So we wanted to make sure that we had a conversation with him today where we could unpack this issue a little bit, talk about it from the city perspective, also talk about it from the regional perspective. So I really appreciate your being here today.
Kathy, thank you for having me on, and thanks for everything you do to get the information out to the community.
It's our pleasure. It's our pleasure and our commitment. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll hear from Mal Vincent, who has a discussion of the new Virginia Stage Company production.
Finally falling back to you.
You might wonder what the dickens Virginia Stage Company is up to in the second all-original production of its new 38th season. This is not a review. No, I have not, as I speak, yet seen Oliver Twist, which is at the Roper Center for the Performing Arts in downtown Norfolk for 18 performances through November 13th. But this show is a risky business in selling as well as in execution. What, after all, is a music-driven adaptation, which it is called? Is it a musical or not? And after all, isn't this a lengthy novel to adapt? But wait a minute. Didn't I have that same trepidation several decades ago when I saw a musical called Oliver in London? Frankly, I thought Lionel Bard, who composed the songs, must be a little bit this side of insane to try and make a musical of Oliver Twist. Well, looking back, we know that Oliver became one of the most loved and hummable musicals of all modern theater. Too many theaters simply attempt to recreate last year's Broadway hit. Virginia Stage Company did a world premiere to open its season, and now it's doing another original version. Creation is greatly preferable to recreation, but still, there is risk. If Olympic divers are judged by the difficulty and originality of their dives, so maybe should theater companies be. The production is written and directed by Patrick Mullins, a good-natured person who is endless energy and is known for both daring and imaginative new takes on Shakespeare. He now turns to Dickens. For my money, Patrick is on the favorable side of the balance if he never does anything else after his amazingly technical Romeo and Juliet and his artful The Tempest. Romeo and Juliet took the sword fights out on Tazewell Street, while the audience stayed in the theater and saw it on closed-circuit TV. I often wondered what people must have thought if they saw guys in tights in a sword fight on Tazewell Street. And The Tempest, which he did in Chrysler Hall for the Virginia Arts Festival, even managed to keep the Shakespeare at the center with a full orchestra and a chorus on stage. They became partners, not competitors. But Patrick can become brash at times. His production of Taming of the Shrew, a so-called rock version, at the Wells Theater was no more than rock caterwauling with confused double casting. And his Midsummer Night's Dream, Outdoors, had fanciful puppets but made no sense. So you see, there can be a fine line between inventive and brash, and we can only hope for the best here. But that's what makes live theater interesting, even exciting. So Oliver Twist is a new adventure, and it will be followed by A Christmas Carol, in which again Scrooge will be encouraged to prove good cheer by giving away his money. But this is going to be an interesting new adventure at the Virginia Stage Company. I may let you know later when I actually see it, but be aware of these risks.
Waiting for reality to break my...
And that's a part of my world. Bye.
Won't you break my fall?
Thank you so much, Mal. That about wraps it up for us on this Thursday. And as you know, Thursdays are Fridays, so we're getting ready to head on out of here. I do want to let you know, though, that coming up next on 89.5, a show that I have never said in 20 years, it's Unearthing Dracula. That's right. No idea what the show is about, but it has to do with Earth and Dracula, apparently. Then tonight on WHRO TV 15, it's This Old House and A Chef's Life. And coming up next week, we continue our election conversations. Lots going on as we head up to the November 8th election day. So I hope you'll be back with us Monday. Thanks for listening. We'll see you then.